This conference will now be recorded.
Hi, it's September 22nd, 2014. This is the first session of the 2014 Lucretius Reading Group. We'll be talking about books 1 and 2. All right, now for all of the listeners listening to this later, and certainly Dwight, for you and for Les, this reading group is one that, you know, this was our first reading group, and some of these readers, as you heard earlier, have been reading together for a long time. We tend to tackle new books together. So unlike, for example, Dwight, your Herodotus reading group, where we have actually a professor of the classics moderating, I moderate this with some help from Pat, and I am definitely not a professor, and this is the first time I'm reading Lucretius. So we read it together and fumble along together in the dark, or if we're able to get a little light going. So let's start. What I'd like to, as most of you know, I'd like to start by asking, a couple of questions. One is, what do you think so far? This is a new kind of work for us to tackle. And then we'll talk about any favorite passages, and then we'll see if we can get into some interesting issues. But general impression so far of our poet. Anyone? Frank, what are you?
I was actually real. You know, I did a little background reading, and I'd read The Swerve last summer.
Yeah.
But just how modern his thinking is, you know, given the fact that it's 2,000 years ago. I mean, just the concept of atoms and the concept of an infinite universe. All that just seems to have such an advanced grasp of, you know, the way we look at the world today, or at least many people look at the world today. So I was really fascinated. Even though, obviously, he doesn't have everything right, I thought it was really eye-opening, just the first two books.
It is remarkable how much he gets right, Frank, isn't it? I mean,
it is, and it just the amount of guesswork and just logic of, you know, how can everything work? You know, how does everything work together? Just surmising so correctly how things do come together and how things do form.
Yeah.
I thought it was fabulous.
Yeah, I agree. What about Bruce? What do you think? General impressions.
I'm sorry, just having a sandwich. I'm just like Frank, same thing. Like, you know, one tends to keep score. Like, I, you know, right, wrong, right, wrong. and he does pretty well. Like a
he gets the first and second law of thermodynamics right, more or less.
Right. I wasn't quite sure if he was right about the Galileo part, where two bodies of different weights will still go at the same speed.
Yes. Yeah. I wasn't clear on that either.
But what moved me even more than all that physics stuff was the humanity of it, like the spirit of almost that Zen-like be here now attitude, because death, we shouldn't be afraid of death. There's no religion. Yeah. It's just whatever you can see.
Yeah. Yeah.
And kind of like the sense of the money doesn't matter, power doesn't matter, vast army doesn't matter, like nothing really matters. Like nothing that you can, it takes you out of the realm of the now matters.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful world. But it's like, it's not a negative feeling. It's more of a celebration.
Yeah. Excellent. Did you, Bruce, refer to both texts that we suggested, or did you find yourself reading more the Copley and not really looking over at the Smith? Or
I think I mostly read Copley, like 95%. I think I might have found myself accidentally in the other one. I couldn't really tell the difference, but yeah, I liked what I was reading.
Yeah. You know, the author who wrote The Swerve, he talks about, I don't know, did you read The Swerve, Bruce?
No. First three chapters,
okay. Yeah. So he talks about, you know, how he found this book, you know, in the Yale remainders for like 10 cents when he was a student, and he ended up reading it. So what he read was the Smith translation, actually. That's the second of the two books, and just FYI. All right, cool. So let's stay with general impressions a little bit longer. Anyone else have other, you know, just general impressions or other things they want to say before we talk about favorite passages?
This is Pat. To me, it seems clear right from the get-go that he's staking out a different value system than a lot of the, you know, dominant culture around him. I mean, he begins the whole thing talking about, you know, making an appeal for peace to Venus, you know, and this in a culture that valued war and, you know, and heroism on the battlefield and all this. And he starts right out saying, I'm not for any of that. It's striking to me that he's taking a, I don't know, for lack of a better word, a countercultural stance, you know, right from the get-go. That's striking.
Yeah. And Smith addresses this a little bit in his preface or introduction, where he talks about first of all, that Lucretius had a pretty big, despite how different Epicureanism was than the dominant Stoicism or other attributes of Roman culture, he had a pretty big influence on some key people, including Virgil. And Dwight, we just read the Aeneid. That was the last text that we read in the spring. So, you know, we're chronologically, we're slightly backwards, but Lucretius did have an impact on some in Rome, certainly more the literate and lettered, and clearly seemingly Virgil.
Well, you could also say that some of those ideas must have been in the air, because some of the, and not just for the wealth, for the rich and powerful, because, you know, some of those views, not all of them, are very much akin to what early Christian beliefs, right? With Jesus, the gospel type content material, right? The power and wealth don't matter, in particular, sort of the social justice part of the message was
right.
You know, and I think I've read that there are those, you know, there are people who theorize that. You know, the gospel writers were influenced by some variant of Epicureanism, you know, and the hostility towards mystery cults and, you know, the Roman religion of the time was, you know, and so that, in other words, that the Jesus gospel was not just, you know, a strand of Jewish extremism, but reflected some views that were in the air in the empire as a whole.
Yeah, good point, Bill.
I also found it interesting that in a lot of ways, you know, I mean, it's sort of Lucretius' atheism is kind of the subject to the accusations that a lot of Christians or religious people make of modern atheism, which I don't think is usually that true, which is that it's really a religion, but his really was a religion. And it's kind of interesting that his religious certainty in his physics is what gives him the confidence to kind of state what was really speculation as absolute certain fact, right? I mean, there was not a lot of science, there was a little bit of science presumably behind his physics, but not that much, yet he is absolutely 100% confident in his truth because his atheism was sort of a, or his quasi-atheism was, you know, a religious belief.
Right. And to be clear, as I think you just clarified, he wasn't actually atheist. He just didn't think God had any impact on the world of humans.
One could ask whether he really believed that. I mean, believed in the gods at all at that point.
Maybe that was just part of his marketing.
the sort of not asking for trouble, the way that the early Christians did by denying the gods altogether, right? It's it's arguably a much more reasonable, moderate stance to say, they exist, but they don't matter, than they don't exist. Not only do they not exist, but they are actually evil.
Right. Right.
This
Josh,
is Dwight. I think.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Dwight.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the interesting thing about the first two chapters to me is he's a very he's looking into material. He's looking into natural arguments for explaining
yeah.
things versus the supernatural. And he's not, again, I don't think he's denying it, but he's, like you said, you know, and as he says in there, like, they're too busy, you know, arguing over their own things. If anybody's seen the movie Eric the Red, where it shows a bunch of Norse gods as kids arguing among each other, destroying each other and everything they do. So it's, that sort of encapsulates, like, you know, his view of the gods for me.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And doesn't he believe that? I mean, I didn't notice or didn't get there that the gods are made of matter, just like we are, of atoms, just like people are. That they're basically just alien creatures.
Does
he says everything.
Does he say that, Bill?
I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm wondering. But he basically says everything that exists
yeah.
is made of atoms. So I'm assuming that would include the gods. Which would mean his view of the gods, if they exist at all, is that they're more like what we would consider space aliens.
Good point.
It's a very good question, actually. He certainly believes that everything is made of atoms. We know that.
He's pretty emphatic.
If you missed it in book one, you got it in book two. All right, cool. Wes, what about you?
No, the physics was actually pretty amazing. I think he missed some minor things. He may have got the acceleration right, but I think he was less than perfect on the gravitational stuff. But I started kind of reconsidering what little bit I knew about physics and thinking I might be wrong. And maybe he is right. And I tried to look at it from his standpoint. And it's really
yeah.
pretty amazing to think of it. And
yeah.
I presumed he spent such a long time, and I've only read the first, and maybe a fraction of book three, but the first two books. And
yeah,
it seems like he's laying the foundation for all that there is to follow, whether it be ethics and, you know, and
yeah.
Other things, so, et cetera, that will be discussed later. It almost seems like he takes a belittling approach to anyone that may disagree with him. I mean,
yeah,
I mean,
yes. Well, he's fairly confident.
Yes, he is.
All right, cool. Well, let me just wrap up this first part by asking Josh if you wanted to add anything.
I think I'm pretty much on the same page as everybody else. I would just add that, you know, as I was reading through it, I kept in mind that this isn't necessarily why he's writing the piece. It's not necessarily his philosophy, that the philosophy ties back to Epicurus and to others before him, really all the way back to the time of Herodotus. So
yeah.
thinking about the earlier readings, you know, these types of discussions, debates, philosophies, you know, we're working in parallel with the other books that we're reading from Herodotus, Thucydides, and others, which makes
yeah.
me learn more about that aspect of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I think, what was the chronology? Epicurus was born, I think, after the Peloponnesian Wars, right? So.
Oh, yeah. After Alexander, in fact, I believe.
Yeah.
Fourth century, I think, something like that.
No, I believe it was 200, 250. I think it was after Alexander.
Really? Okay. I thought it was the 300s, but whatever. Yeah, we can... It was the 300s?
I think it was at the end of Alexander's time frame, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, we can confirm that. All right, cool. Well, let's just spend a moment now.
341 BC.
341. Okay, good. I thought so, yeah. So let's spend a moment talking about favorite passages. So, Pat, can I call on you to pick out one of your favorite passages from the reading we did here?
Sure. There's just one early on. It's on page 4 of the Copley edition, line 146, starting on line 140, I guess five or six.
Okay, hang on a second. Hang on. Let's get there, and I gotta learn how to use my reading glasses. take these dang things off and on. Okay. All right, here we go. I'm there.
this fright, this night of the mind, must be dispelled not by the rays of the sun, nor day's bright spears, but by the face of nature and her laws. I just love the phrase night of the mind, which is so picturesque and evocative of, you know, the fear of the unknown. And I like that he's saying that knowledge is power, that's the way we dispel the fear of the unknown, is by coming to know and understand things. It's a surprisingly modern viewpoint.
Yeah. I love that phrase, night of the mind. That's great. I had underlined the sentence 150 that comes just, you know, nothing was ever by miracle made from nothing, which obviously is key to the whole thing. But I hadn't underlined night of the mind, and I'm thrilled that you called that out. Great. All right, what else? Bruce, do you have a passage you'd like to elucidate, highlight? Are you with us, Bruce?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute.
Yeah.
I had night of the mind. Pat, you took it. You took that from me.
I'm so sorry, Bruce.
Okay. Here we go. Wait, is this the one? There's a way to do notes in Kindle, right, that you highlighted. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, here it is. Here it is. This is what I was talking about. And this is on, this is book, this might be book two, line 37.
All right, hang on. All right.
And so, since wealth's no profit to the flesh, that one? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Whatever. Nor noble blood, nor royal power, it follows that they can't benefit the soul. Unless I'm seeing your legions in the field, a charge and countercharge of wild war games, backed by cavalry staunchly masked. There's a couple missing lines there. Full armed alike with weapons and with courage, you see your far-flung fleet come boiling in. And your religion, terrified by these sights, flees, fluttering from your soul in fears of death, then leave your heart released and free of care. I don't know what Copley's doing, but he's got the far-flung fleet flees fluttering.
Yeah.
Something going on there. But I think it was a nice
lovely alliteration. Yeah.
Yeah. Fluttering from your soul in fears of death, leave your heart released.
Yeah. That's a great... So let's see. What is he saying here, Bruce?
Well, it's weird because he's got these two images conflicting with each other. He's got this conflict and tension with legions in the field and war games, and they're wild, and there's cavalry, and everyone's armed and charging, boiling, and then. But the whole point is to show that, you know, this is enough to chase religion away, and it's foolish.
So the thing I'm confused about this is he saying that war chases religion away? Is that what he's saying?
He says it's all of it is it's absurd.
I guess,
I agree with Bruce, you know, it's, you know, say part of it is, you know, people view religion as giving order to the world, right? And so when you see all this, you know, this wild warfare that makes any, you know, that makes a joke of the concept of order, they say, what does religion have to do with it? So this doesn't make any sense. I think that's, you know, just kind of supporting Bruce's view. You know?
Yeah.
The insanity of war makes you realize that religion is ridiculous as well.
Right. Now, I'll point out to Josh, I think it was Josh's point earlier about seeing some of the parallels to earlier reading. At the bottom of this page 30, line 77, he says, "One nation grows, another wastes away. The ranks of the living change in one brief hour. Like racers, they hand along the torch of life." And I underlined, "One nation grows, another wastes away." Do you remember the introduction to Herodotus?
Yeah.
Where Herodotus says, we're going to talk about cities that are great as well as those that are small, because cities that were once great are small today, and those that are small today may become great. I was thinking of Herodotus when I read that line, which perhaps Epicurus and Lucretius were influenced by. Okay, great. What else do we like here? Les, do you have a favorite passage? One, you know, you can have multiple ones. Just pick one.
Okay, I'm gonna pick a couple of general areas. Thanks, Phil. One is not a specific line. It's just his the very first part of book one where he invokes Venus, notwithstanding the, you know, deity.
Yeah.
It's to me, it just struck like I'm reading Homer, or you know, like the Iliad or the Odyssey. They're asking for their muse to come help them write as best they can, to show the people as best they can what message they have to give them creativity and ability. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting. When I read it, it just reminded me of the Homeric books. And then the other thing, which was interesting, though the passages y'all brought were all beautiful, the ones mentioned so far. But at book two, it's not so nice, but it's just interesting. Just the first paragraph or so of book two on page 29, where he talks, it's kind of just schadenfreude, you know, showing how bad your neighbors can be who are in turmoil, and how peaceful it must be for you to not have to sweat that kind of stuff. It just seemed just unusual to read to me. Not necessarily poetic. It's just an unusual sentiment to make.
Let's read the first four lines of book two.
Okay. "It's sweet when winds blow wild on open seas to watch from land your neighbor's vast travail. Not that men's miseries bring us dear delight, but that to see what ills we're spared is sweet. Sweet, too, to watch the cruel contest of war ranging the field when you need to share no danger. But nothing is sweeter than to dwell in peace high in the well-walled temples of the wise." And it goes on about looking down upon the travails of men.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was interesting. I didn't... Certainly not too different than some of his almost arrogance, or let's say extreme confidence in what he's been saying. But, you know, it's kind of poetic in some of the ways he said it, but just an interesting shot in.
Now,
when
I read that line, "not that men's miseries bring us dear delight, but that to see what ills we're spared is sweet," I was thinking, now he is really giving humanity the benefit of the doubt there, because I think actually that many people do take great pleasure in watching the miseries of others, and not just be, you know, in and of itself, it seems to at least appeal to some. But good, yeah. All right. And then, you know, and by the way, this, what you read, I think helps illuminate Bruce's passage, because he makes clear here up at the top that it's not a, you know, to dwell in peace is the way to go. And I think that gives better context to that. Okay.
Nothing is
good. Dwight, what about you?
Well, I had actually chosen the first part of book two to talk about.
Okay.
Which you just read the first part of. And I'm reading from the Martin Ferguson Smith edition, so I apologize for being different.
Hang on a minute. Some of us have the Smith edition with us. Let me catch up to you. Okay. Where are you? On page 35?
35.
Okay.
And I'll read like about the first 10 lines, if that's okay.
Yeah.
It is comforting when winds are whipping up the waters of the vast sea to watch from land the severe trials of another person. Not that anyone's distress is a cause of agreeable pleasure, but it is comforting to see from what troubles you yourself are exempt. It is comforting also to witness mighty clashes of warriors embattled on the plains when you have no share in the danger. So in other words, you're just an observer. And nothing is more blissful than to occupy the heights effectively fortified by the teaching of the wise, tranquil sanctuaries from which you can look down upon others and see them wandering everywhere in a random search for the way of life, competing for intellectual eminence, disputing about rank, and striving night and day with prodigious effort to scale the summit of wealth and to secure power. So to me, this was almost like proselytizing for the Epicurean religion or way of thought, school of thought, whatever.
Yeah.
And there's a note there saying that, you know, a lot of people think this is egoism, a taste of cruelty. I don't see it this way. I saw it as sort of this setting yourself aside from all the crap that everybody else is going through.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think creating a contrast where Epicurus's vision is much more positive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and to the person that had made the comment earlier about it being an epic read, I mean, there's lots of places in here like that. This is one. And then there's also sort of the tie into Christianity where they sort of have the same message. It's like, you know, everything else that people are worrying about, it's not worth it. You're worrying about the wrong things. And that's sort of the message I got from this passage.
I have to admit that reading Lucretius here, and at least in these first two books, I felt like the Reading Odyssey project as a whole is really fundamentally Epicurean in its approach. Turns out we're all more or less Epicureans here, putting more stock in the opportunity to learn and create community with each other, as opposed to mindless, prodigious efforts to scale the summits of wealth. Although, if someone wanted to give us a lot of money, I'm sure we would be happy to accept it.
only in the name of good purpose.
Yes, exactly. Okay, Bill, what about you?
I'm a little behind. I read the original email that said just to read the introductions.
Oh, good. Well, is there something in the introductions that you
And I did start reading book. I got through a little bit of book one. So I'm pretty early in book one. I like the passage, the passage at the in early in book one where he talks about Agamemnon's sacrifice of his daughter and how horrific that was. And it's all the fault of religion.
Right. And there's that famous quote. So let's go look at those lines, Bill. So let's see. Where are we?
I mean, it's line 80, you know, like line 80, 85.
Yeah.
Religion has prompted vile and vicious acts.
Right. So line 101, I think it should be line 101 in both do you have both translations, Bill?
Yeah, I'm looking at the Copley one right now.
Okay. So why don't you read around, you know, why don't you read for us, you know, somewhere ending with so much of evil could religion prompt. So pick a point in that.
Well, it's they coiffed the poor girl for her wedding day, a ribbon, long braids to hang each side of her face. But there by the altar, she saw her father standing grief-stricken, and near him, acolytes hiding knives and people staring at her with tear-stained faces. Which, you know, just the image of that is just so pathetic.
Yeah.
Voiceless
yeah.
with terror, she crumbled to her knees. Poor thing, no help to her in such an hour that she'd been first to call the king my father. You know, and then, you know, they led her to the altar, all trembling, not to say their sacred office and carry her home with a nuptial shout and song, but her innocence at the bridal hour fall criminal victim by a father's blow, that ships might have clear sailing and fair winds. So much of evil could religion prompt. You could also say politics and war, right? They're all kind of implicated in this horrific act. But you know, the anger is for the religion that sanctified it. And the superstition that led him to believe it would make a difference.
And in the Smith translation on page 6 at the top, he translates that final line as such heinous acts could superstition prompt. So in the Copley, it's so much of evil could religion prompt, and in the Smith, it's such heinous acts could superstition prompt. And there's a footnote there, line 12. He says it's a famous line, and it's been a long time since I studied Latin, so I'll try to get the pronunciation to the accepted way of doing it these days. But tantum religio potuit suadere malorum, which Voltaire predicted would last as long as the world. Wow.
You know, it's sort of an interesting example to use of Agamemnon, because in the Iliad, you know, the gods weren't superstitions. They were very real actors in that story.
Yes. Yes. They were. And I agree, Josh. There's more to say about that. But Josh, what about you? Do you have a passage you'd like to point us to?
I certainly have a lot of post-its in these books, but one of the passages that I thought was interesting was actually in the Smith edition in the introduction on page 31, where he's describing a little bit about Epicureans and how they've sort of been mischaracterized as, you know, hedonists. But there's a quote here, which I think is from Epicurus. It's not exactly clear, but Phil, this I think ties back to your earlier comment about if someone wants to give the Reading Odyssey money, I think you might want to read this as well. At the top of 31, it says, "If you wish to make Pythocles rich, do not increase his means, but diminish his desire." For the heart of the Epicurean philosophy is not about more, but it's about managing your desires, living a simpler life. I think someone talked earlier about, the tie-ins perhaps with early Christianity, and you could certainly see Jesus saying something like that, similar in the New Testament.
Yeah, that's great.
You can never have too much means. You can never have too much money. So you have to control your desire. I think that's a good point.
Well, I think the thing is, it's also, if you want to, you know, part of it, if, you know, to feel rich, I mean, some people feel rich because they get more, and some people feel rich because they have simpler desires, right? If I don't feel that I need as much money, I'll be happier with less.
This also, you know, this speaks to the concept that a lot of people talk about today that I certainly agree with, that if you want to, you know, if you want to be happier, lower your expectations, right?
Yeah.
If you want to be rich, then just decrease how much you want. Because, I mean, the fact is that all of us on the call today, whatever our means are, we live as rich as Croesus lived. And, you know, there was a great analysis done recently that looked at King Henry VIII and his household wealth, and, you know, and counted the number of plates and cups and, you know, the various things that he had access to. And really, almost, certainly I would think all of us on the phone today are as rich as King Henry was, in terms of the things that we have around us. And of course, we have things that not even King Henry could have, like antibiotics and air conditioning and iPhones.
You know, Phil, and actually that strikes me to the passage that I told you, because I think
a lot of it is, you know, people like to accumulate things because I think they're afraid of death. And, you know, and I think the accumulation of worldly goods sometimes is the barrier that people try to build against death and against time. And the one person that I had marked off is in book one, which is up line 458.
Is this in the Copley?
The Copley, though, maybe pickups. I picked up the Smith as well, which is a slightly different translation. But it says, time doesn't exist as such, but from events our senses gather what happened in the past, what things are with us, and what are going to be. No man may assert senses time as such, discrete from things in motion and things at rest. And when you read the Smith one, it says, likewise, time has no independent existence. Rather, from events themselves is derived the sense of what has occurred in time past, of what is happening at present, and of what is to follow in the future. And it must be admitted that no one has a sense of time as an independent entity, but only as something relative against the movement of things and their restful calm. So I thought that was a pretty interesting concept. And, you know, just listening to you guys talking about wealth and all that, just really, I think, in putting time as something that, you know, just is experiential as opposed to, you know, a thing, I think it helps put that into a stark relief.
I assume Einstein read these lines. Perhaps he got his idea about relativity from Lucretius. I marked this, Frank. I like these lines as well, but I thought, holy moly, so he's saying time is relative. Holy moly. I had no idea that anyone had clearly articulated that before Einstein. And maybe others had, actually, but Einstein was the first to prove it. I don't know. I don't think so, but.
Well, that's
great.
A pretty great line right there.
Yeah. Thank you, Frank. Good. Has anyone not shared a favorite passage? Did everyone get a chance? Okay, let me share a couple of mine. This is in the Smith translation, if you have it. It's actually right after Bill Swislow's section in the beginning. So it's like page 6 of the Smith, line 105, 4 or 5. This is after such heinous acts could superstition prompt. Next paragraph, the time may come when you yourself, terrorized by the fearsome pronouncements of the fable mongers, will attempt to defect from us, Epicureans, is what he's saying there. Consider how numerous are the fantasies they can invent, capable of confounding your calculated plan of life and clouding all your fortunes with fear. And with reason, for if people realized that there was a limit set to their tribulations, they would somehow find strength to defy irrational beliefs and the threats of the fable mongers. So there's a lot to say about this section, but I loved fable mongers. Absolutely loved that phrase. Now, interestingly, if you go to the Copley, same section, let's see if I can find it. I got my mind. Okay, so it's page 3, book 1 of Copley. Middle of the page, it's like one line 102. It starts with and you at any moment now, in fear of hierophantic threats, will seek to leave me. Well, so by the way, that's the line that Smith said, the time may come when you yourself, terrorized by the fearsome pronouncements of the fable mongers, will attempt to defect from us. Copley says, and you at any moment now, in fear of hierophantic threats, will seek to leave me. I have to say, I like this. In this case, I certainly like the Smith translation better. And what is a hierophantic threat? I had to go look that up. It turns out it is a Greek origin word, and hierophant is someone who pronounces and promotes worship of the gods and religion. So he's basically saying priestly threats or something like that there. But I just couldn't stand how much I like the phrase fable mongers. So that was one thing I wanted to share. And then the second one was from book 2. And there was a lot of cool things in book two, and we have to make sure we discuss the swerve before we end tonight, since that's such an important concept. But can I find this other thing that I...
While you're doing that, Phil, can I just chime in something here?
Sure.
It's just striking to me that Copley's translation is, or let me put it this way, Smith's translation, Lucretius comes across in that passage much more openly anti-religious than in Copley's translation.
Right. Yes.
In Copley, he seems to simply not want to be, you know, misunderstood. In Smith, he's saying religion is nothing but superstition and nonsense.
Much angrier.
And it's, you know, it's priests and practitioners are simply flimflam men, you know.
Right.
I think that probably Smith takes more liberties than Copley does with the original Latin.
And, you know, I have to say that I've read that Lucretius was more angry than Epicurus at religion. So this is a good point worth learning more about, and I can ask some of our scholar friends if they have a point of view on the difference in those two translations and which more reflects Lucretius, and at least as they understand it.
So if I'm thinking 50 BC, you're sticking your neck out pretty far to go really anti-religion.
Yeah.
And they were busy chopping people's heads off in those days. So,
yeah. You know. And remember, it's so interesting. He's writing this as the Republic is falling apart. You know, he's just a few years older than Cicero. And so everything is being shaken. Pretty significantly. All right, the other passage I wanted to share is on page 50 of the Copley, line 930. The one line, which of course, I love this line, we rightly conclude that sense comes from nonsense. Now, what he means by that, he actually isn't like saying nonsense here. I mean, the phrase to him has real meaning, right? Because what he's saying in the passage above is that sensing beings are made up of atoms that do not sense, that are not sentient. And so for Lucretius, it's important for us to understand that sense comes from nonsense. And on page, the next page over, line 986, it says, if man made of non-laughing stuff can laugh, and then he goes on. But I love those lines.
Didn't he also say later on, like, given the way all the atoms bounce off each other, that everything that happened once will happen again? And then I first thought when I read that part, I thought of the million monkeys banging away on millions of typewriters.
Really? Does he say that, Bruce? I don't remember that.
Yeah, I thought where were you in Copley with that part?
When I was reading, this was pages 50, 51 in Copley.
Okay. 50. Okay, here we go. I thought I read, was that, or maybe it was in the swerve?
In the book?
Yeah,
the
here
swerve?
It is. Here, I think, then too, what came from Earth must return. Let's see. I'm going to have to come back to you.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. So let me just look at the time here. All right. So it's almost 9 Eastern time. Let's just talk for a moment about the swerve. Not the book, I mean, but the concept in Lucretius. So I'm looking for it. Here we go. In the Copley, it's on page 34. Would anyone like to just try to explain what the swerve is all about?
Wait, okay, I found it. I'm sorry, I found it.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Okay, page 53.
Okay.
So atoms and countless countless speed through the depths of all a thousand ways and never rest, that only our earth and sky have been created.
Wait, give us the line number.
10556.
Okay, go. Oh, okay, yep, okay.
Yeah, after all, our world was made by nature. When atoms meeting by chance spontaneously and joined in myriad useless, fruitless ways, at last found patterns which, when thrown together, became at once the origin of great things. Earth, sea, sky, all life in all its forms. So we were formed out of chaos and nonsense.
Yeah. Right. And by the way, right there, that's Darwin. That is amazing. You know, that is evolution by random selection.
Right.
Wow.
And then earlier he said that the I know for a fact that God didn't create this place because it's full of flaws.
Like, oh, that. Yes. That was a great passage. I underlined that as well.
Yeah.
Which is the inverse of the intelligent design argument today, which is that there's no way this can't have been not designed by God because of the perfect, you know, design of the eye or what have you.
Right.
I thought that was, I really enjoyed that. All right, so let's just touch base on the swerve concept. Would anyone like to attempt to explain what the swerve is all about? Well, let's go to page 12 of the introduction. So in the second paragraph of page 12, would anyone like to read sort of the first four, five, six lines of this? Pat, can I call on you? So
yeah, this is page 12 in the introduction.
Yeah, the Copley. First full paragraph begins with Democritus had taught.
Yep. Democritus had taught that the natural motion of the atom is downward, but if all atoms move only in downward paths, paralleling each other, how could they meet to form the compounds that make up sensible things? Epicurus's answer to this problem was perhaps his one great stroke of genius. He theorized that, at times not predictable and for no assignable reason, the atom must swerve from its downward path. But no sooner has it swerved than it strikes its neighbor atom and drives it also from its downward path. This strikes another and another and another and so on, until the universe, instead of being a kind of rainfall of atoms, comes much more closely to resemble an atomic whirlwind, with atoms striking against each other and clinging or springing back, moving now one way, now another, driven partly by their own weight, partly by the impulses given them by other atoms, a vast confusion in which only the law of chance governs the formation of specific atomic compounds.
Yeah.
So he's, he sort of clarifies it further in the next paragraph. I don't know if we want to keep going there, but.
Yeah. Why don't you just take those next few, I think there's one long sentence there in that first paragraph. The next paragraph is pretty good.
Thus, the inherent power of the atom to move by its own weight, plus its equally inherent power to swerve from its normal path, plus its power to cling together with other atoms, both like and unlike itself, plus the law of chance, can and do account of and by themselves, without the intervention of any outside force or guiding intelligence, for every form of being that can be observed by one or another of our senses. The disciplined observation of the sensible world will reveal to us with accuracy and truth the nature of every phenomenon that occurs or may occur anywhere in the universe.
I want to know if Darwin read this. It's too.
You know, there's a reasonable chance that he did if he had a classical education.
Yeah.
To me, it's almost like quantum mechanics. Like you don't know where an electron will be at any given
right.
time.
Right.
And synchronicity and the whole bag of uncertainty and unpredictability about certain things. You can know some things about it, but not others. It's almost like that. It's almost like the unknown of quantum mechanics is to how his
right.
atoms move around. Now that may be, you know, great anachronism, but you know, too anachronistic probably, but that's what it reminds me of.
Yes.
If you insert gravitational theory here, it actually works pretty well.
Now, I don't know about the initial principles of paralleling falling atoms. I mean, Democritus is probably a little softer than Lucretius, but I don't know how that came into being. But taking that as your model, I think it's pretty amazing. I mean,
yeah.
Take it back to the Big Bang. We have all these atoms being shot not downwards but outwards. How do they, you know, how do they divert from that outward path to coalesce into molecules?
Yeah.
You know, worlds, galaxies.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
a lot
good
of that
point.
Is
good
gravity
point.
That's causing them to swerve right from their outward path and pull together and interact with each other in various ways.
Yeah.
This is Dwight. I had two problems with this. And this, again, this is my first time through, so I'm still thinking through it.
So it's all of our first time through.
Okay. Okay. So he makes it clear earlier, there's two things that make up matter, atoms and the void. So atoms can swerve. Can the void swerve?
No, the void is the absence of matter.
Yeah, the void is nothing.
Yeah.
But still, with... Okay, so in some sense, it's swerving too as atoms take up space. So I don't know. I have a little problem with that. And again, I haven't thought it all the way through. The other thing is it felt like some sort of ad hoc argument for free will. You know, he's going from this to explaining free will in man. It's like, okay, the atoms have free will. They can swerve. Men can swerve. I don't know. It just felt a little forced to me, like he's coming up with this ad hoc argument to explain why man does what he does. And I may be the only one that sees that or feels that way.
I haven't gotten to the free will part, but from my reading of the introduction of Copley is that it will make reference to the swerve, which is in and of itself a little different, but I don't know how we're going to tie in free will to the swerve, but
I think there is a case for free will that must get developed, but I actually saw this as more of a way of sort of embracing chaos, the chaos that is observable in the world, and sort of making it into a positive. Right.
Well, I think just a few lines later, he ties it into the free will. You know, and again, I'm reading from the Smith version, but about 252 to about 260, especially about 257. What I ask is the source of this power of will wrested from destiny. I mean, that's free will, which enables each of us to advance where pleasure leads us and to alter our movements. Not at a fixed time or place, but the direction of our own minds. So,
but
I guess the
argument for free will is if it was just that, it wouldn't be that interesting. But I think what is interesting is he's basically saying, because the universe is a chaotic place, not only does that explain why matter why we exist, because without that chaos, everything would be, with perfect order, nothing would exist, because there would be no change. But that because it's chaotic and changeable, there is free will, right? You can make your own decisions because there's no overarching order that dominates everything. Which, right. I think is kind of interesting. If it was just about free will, I think you'd be right. It would be like, well, that's a little forced.
Right.
There's no divine intervention.
Not only that,
right.
though, but there's no ultimate order. He's saying that there's no real order, which isn't true, actually. But, that's probably where his mistake actually is. There is order, but it's not observable, to us in most cases.
And it's also not intelligently designed.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Not designed for our well-being or our existence.
Right.
Yeah, I'm taking it to mean partly that it doesn't exist for a purpose,
Right.
It's, which is sort of central to any system of divine that calls for divine intervention. It's always the sense of order all depends on that there is a predetermined purpose of some kind.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it points back to one of the passages we were talking about earlier where, he's describing war and saying, it makes a joke of religion. Because there is, it seems to be disorderly.
Right.
I mean, his concepts all tie together.
Now, by the way, I found online that Darwin was asked late in life if he had ever read Lucretius. And he stated to the incredulous questioner that he, in fact, had not.
He could have lied.
Exactly.
you see artists and pop stars are always denying, they were influenced by anybody.
Right, exactly. It seems to, maybe he didn't, but boy, oh boy. It sure reads as the clear, almost some of the clearest language I've read, including I've read some of the pre-Darwinian, evolutionists who didn't quite understand evolution by natural selection and so forth. This is pretty amazing. Well, this has been a great call, guys. My proposal is that we go ahead and wrap up. We will next meet in October, and actually, let me see if I have the date here on my calendar. Is it the 27th? Is that when it is? Yeah, Monday, October 27th. So just a little more than a month. So for those of you who haven't fully read books 1 and 2, that should give you time to do that. Along with 3 and 4, if you're feeling ambitious and you have a little bit of extra time, I do recommend reading even just the introduction to the Swerve, if not the first couple of chapters or whatever of that book. And I'm going to go looking around for some writings by Epicurus himself, especially his letter to Herodotus, which I'd like to see if I could dig up and share with all of you. But otherwise, I think that's it. Yeah? Any final points?
Bill, I had a question about The Swerve, the book.
Yeah.
The Swerve. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I was reading some of the reviews of it online, and there seems to be some controversy around it where people are suggesting that he gives far too much credit to Lucretius in terms of the influence it had on the Renaissance, whereas others see it differently, obviously. And I don't know if you have any input on that or know anybody who maybe could comment for us on.
I know that Paul Cartledge liked the book quite a lot. And when I read the book and I just reread the first couple of chapters, in his introduction, he says very clearly several times that he's not proposing that Lucretius caused the Renaissance. He says it was one of the important influences, but something as complex as the Renaissance, you can't actually tie to a single event or work. but he argues that Lucretius played an important and certainly unhidden role to those of us who aren't scholars. So I would question those critical reviewers that they might have not really read the book closely enough, in my opinion, when they make that kind of statement.
Actually, my reading The Swerve by Greenblatt got me to read Lucretius.
Yeah.
Actually, I like Lucretius better, to be honest. But
I do too. You know, I liked the first couple of chapters of Greenblatt, and then it sort of ran out of steam for me. Yes, I like Lucretius better as well.
So I'll agree that, you know, his introduction does make it clear, don't read too much into it, but then he seems to go against it at times in the text.
Okay. Well, that's what happens when you're a writer and you run out of steam, is you start, despite yourself making extravagant claims for your subject, right? That's what biographers do that all the time, right? I mean, they end up getting...
It's trying to have it both ways.
Yeah, and you kind of are forced to, in order to keep people feeling that what you're writing is important, you overstate, you know, the claims that you're making for your subject. I mean, that's, which is what it feels like happens in that book to some extent.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Jumps the shark in the middle of his book.
Yeah.
Thanks, Fonzie.
I enjoyed it, gentlemen. Are we about at an end?
Yeah.
Yep.
I was going to say, Pat?
Yep.
Yeah, this is the last Shoppy. One of the odd things that I do in my spare time is I DJ at Rice Radio, and I do a general shift, and I also help with the Americana show. And I've heard of Brother Son, but I've never played any of their music, but I will.
Well, I'm happy to shoot you a CD.
I would be more than happy, but I can get it either way. I just want to let you know that there's not many, you know, Americana souls out there sometimes.
Yeah, we'd love to be a part of it. And, you know, let's exchange emails. Phil, do you have his email there?
Yeah, I do. I don't have it right in front of me, but I can.
Sometime in the next day.
Please go ahead and send it to him, and or any other communication would be fine. It's pretty straightforward email. I'd give it out if this wasn't going to be an audio on the internet.
Right.
That's really terrific. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. No, my pleasure.
Well,
all right. Thank you, everybody.
Hey, thank you, Phil.
Everyone, have a good night.
All right. Take care, everyone.
The organizer has disconnected, and this conference will continue for 60 minutes.